That's the end of the story of the Chartist movement then, First National Mass Working Class Movement, not a political party but involving many things which later will be the domain of political parties. There are two more things I want to talk about this morning. First of all, one of the questions about the leadership. Who were the leaders? Who were the leaders, first thing? And then secondly, I want to look at later parliamentary reform, the Second Reform Act of 1867, and the Third Reform Act of 1884, I think, and how, bizarrely enough, the movement will go down, and then all the demands of the movement will be successful in the next 50 years. So the big, big paradox of Chartism, really, the big question, when we were 16 at school, the question was always, why did Chartism fail? Which is a very, very difficult question, because it's not, since all its demands were established in the next 50 years, yeah, you could say, why did Chartism succeed? It's always very, very difficult to know if movements succeed or fail, because sometimes they fail in their immediate objective, but there are other reforms because the elite is frightened, or they fail in their immediate objective, but they form the base of an organization which will be able to do other things. It's a very complicated question. But first of all, who were the leaders? So let's just look at three or four of them to see what kind of people these were. So I want to start with Bronsair O'Brien. I'm only going to talk about four leaders, the four most famous leaders, but it should give us some idea. And I wanted to talk about the leaders because I said at the beginning of the course that I wanted to avoid suggesting that history is what great men do, that a few great individuals change the world, because I don't think it's a very accurate way of looking at the world. Nevertheless, leaders are important sometimes, so I don't want to go the other extreme and say it doesn't matter who they are, because of course it does. Bronsair O'Brien will have a long history of agitation, but really will become most famous after the first Chartist petition. He will be taken to trial in 1840, and interestingly enough, he will refuse to have a lawyer. He will say that he wants to defend himself, and he is acquitted. He is found not guilty at Newcastle on a charge of conspiracy, but a little later, he is found guilty in Liverpool of seditious speaking. I don't know how you translate seditious speaking. Je sais pas, discours de trahison, quelque part, discours de sédition, de subversion. And he is sent to prison for 18 months. Towards the end of his prison sentence, he begins to write again in the press, and becomes part of a important debate between O'Brien and Fergus O'Connor, who I will talk about in a moment. And this debate will become quite personal. And a little later you will find O'Brien calling O'Connor the dictator. He's saying, oh, he's a dictator, he wants to dominate the movement. And O'Connor will reply and call him the starved viper, you know, le vipère affamé. Very, very nice, friendly sort of thing to call each other. So the beginnings of this conflict will be political. O'Connor believes that it is possible, because the government is weak, it's a weak government, it is possible to make a temporary alliance with the Conservatives against the Whigs. Yeah, so O'Connor is what is, of course, part of the Chartist movement, and he says, well, look, the government is a Whig government, and there are elections. What we should do, in order to put pressure on the Whig government, we should tell everybody to vote Conservative, to vote against them, not because we are Conservative, but as a tactical thing. And O'Brien says, no, that's a terrible idea. That tactic is a terrible idea because the Conservatives represent the Tories represent the opposite of our ideals. So interesting debates, which have not finished today. Again, what tactics are acceptable? Who is it acceptable to join with? What you see in the municipal elections in France today, the Communist Party in some towns has an alliance with the Modem, and this is very controversial. Yeah. So it's not an old question. It's still around. To go back to the story of O'Brien comes out of prison, becomes responsible for different newspapers. He runs a newspaper called the British Statesman. Yeah, L'Homme d'État Britannique. The title is not an accident. Remember that one of the other leaders has a title called the Poor Man's Guardian. You can see the difference in political opinion between the Poor Man's Guardian and the British Statesman. It's not the same atmosphere. It's not the same atmosphere as the idea. And he then, in 1845, O'Brien becomes the editor of the National Reformer. Writes a lot of articles on his proposals for economic reform, in particular for reforming the banking the banking system. O'Brien in 1848 will be one of the strongest defenders of moral force. He will speak against physical force, so he will be one of the people who's saying, no, we must not march on Parliament. We must not march on Parliament. Moral force is what counts. We're not interested in frightening them. And he will continue after the collapse of Chartism. He will establish the National Reform League a little later on. And he will produce another newspaper, The Power of the Pence, Le Pouvoir des Pennies, Pouvoir des Centimes, si vous voulez. Work for many other newspapers, write pamphlets about Napoleon Bonaparte, write pamphlets about Robespierre. He will be active against the Crimean War. In the late 1850s, he will be active against the Crimean War, la guerre de Crimée. He will die very poor. Several times he has to sell all his books to get food. So, interesting case. What do we see from this little biography of Grandpère O'Brien? First of all, it's a tremendous to be a leader of a social movement in the 19th century. You really need to be very determined. Yeah, prison, poverty. This is normal. Secondly, the leaders seem to be people who were so determined they continue for 20, 30, 40 years. Yeah. Even after the end of Chartism, oh well, another campaign for something else, yeah. Leaders. Thirdly, you see the internal fighting, the fighting between leaders, where the base is a political difference, different to political opinions, but the debate becomes personal. Interestingly enough, this seems to be a universal law of social movements. There always seems to be some personal conflicts as well. I think this is also the case in football teams, theatre companies, and other kinds of organisations as well. But it's not unusual to see this sort of thing. Although quite often the basis is political, and then it becomes personal. In particular, it has to be said that when a movement is going down, the personal conflicts become more important. When it's going up, it's easy to feel united, yeah? It's when it's going down. It's your fault. It's her fault it's going down. That's how I see it. Okay, so that was Brontë O'Brien, one example. Fergus O'Connor then. I mentioned Fergus O'Connor in connection with the land plan. Fergus O'Connor, then one of the important leaders, born in 1796. Irishman, Irish Protestant. Remember that's important. Irish Protestant. So from quite a good family. I mean in the sense that quite a relatively rich family, his first involvement in politics was a campaign against the paying of the tithes in Ireland, donc une campagne contre le paiement de la dîme, which was considered to be too expensive. He was arrested in 1832 as part of this campaign. And he was elected Member of Parliament. I can't remember. He was involved in the anti-tithe agitation, the campaign against tithes, the campaign against church taxes, against not taxes, Paddy, the taxia, the example. Yeah, okay, there were no taxes at the time. He also was in favour of Irish independence. Interesting case, yeah. Protestant leader in favour of Irish independence. This is rather exceptional. Yeah, normally the majority of people in favour of Irish independence were Catholics. So O'Connor becomes a member of Parliament, but then loses his position as member of Parliament because he no longer has enough money. Remember that under the old law, under the electoral law at the time, you need, I think, £10 a year to vote, but you also need a certain quantity of property if you want to be a member of Parliament. And O'Connor had enough property, and then later they discovered that he didn't have enough property anymore, and so he lost his seat because of that. That must have been very, had a big effect on him. He joined the Chartists, went around the country making speeches, calling for the Charter, and in 1836 he joins the London Working Men's Association, and will establish in Leeds the Northern Star, one of the most popular newspapers of Chartism. He will establish it, the Northern Star, and this will sell, this will be selling at this time 48,000 copies a week. Now, they will sell 48,000 every week, which at the time is absolutely extremely impressive. Yeah, the Northern Star, he will establish this in Leeds in 1837. Am I talking too fast? Yeah. He will establish this newspaper in Leeds in 1837. It is one of the most popular of the Chartist newspapers, and at this time they sell 48,000 every week, which is extremely impressive. O'Connor is a leader at this time, is a leader of physical force, and he will give speeches which are quite dramatic. He will say, "I am willing to die for the Charter. We will lead people to death or glory." That's so quite a dramatic way of assumption. Not so surprising, really, death or glory. Not so surprising. People are convinced, well, first of all, people know death. They see death all the time. People are always dying. And secondly, they really believe that if we have the votes, we will transform society and there will be no more poverty. And so the idea of a fight to the death is not ridiculous in this section. He is too much in favour of physical force for the taste of some other leaders, and he is marginalised. He forms a new organisation and finds himself in prison because of what of articles published in the Northern Star. He comes out of prison in 1841 and again is tried after the general strike of 1842. He is tried. He is tried in the tribunal, but he is not sent to prison. He is manages to avoid that. 1845, he is the person who launches the land plan, and very, very ambitious. What does he say about the land plan? He says, "This plan will change the whole face of society in 12 months. Yeah? The land plan va transformer la société d'ici un an. It's easier to say than to do, of course. Yeah? And he says, "This plan will make a paradise of England in less than 5 years." Okay, so big promises, yeah? Big promises there. 70,000 people participate in the land plan. 70,000, yeah, good deal. But I mentioned that what the situation was. And O'Connor will crack up in his final years and will end up in a mental asylum and die in 1855 in a mental asylum. And again, you know, this, at the time people just say he went mad. But given that he had such a long history of writing and thinking and so on, I think it's reasonable to consider that the pressure is just too much for some people. Here I have a short extract of his speech at 1848. The big demonstration in 1848 was on Kennington Common. Kennington Common. This is the demonstration where they were supposed to march on the Parliament, but they didn't. Okay? And this is what he said. My children, I have now for a quarter of a century been mixed up with the democratic movement. In Ireland since 1822, and in England from the year 1833. I have always, in and out of Parliament, contended for your rights. And I have received more than 100 letters telling me not to come here today or my life would be sacrificed. My answer was that I would rather be stabbed in the heart than abstain from being in my place. And my children, for you are my children, and I am only your father and bailiff, but I am your fond father and unpaid bailiff. Okay, so interesting thing on the style of speeches. Yeah, if you want to be a successful politician today, it's better not to begin your speeches with mes enfants. Ça passe pas super bien. Imaginez un candidat au présidentiel qui vous s'adresse aux Français au téléphone, à la télévision, et commence à mes enfants, j'ai quelque chose à vous dire. Yeah, it's a little bit difficult. Yeah, so a different atmosphere at the time. Figures so Connor then again. So somebody comes from quite a relatively rich family. This is a case which we will see in other movements as well. Quite frequently, the leaders come from relatively comfortable families. Perhaps this is because you learn to be confident. Not the case of everyone. Everybody. The next guy I'm going to look at, Julian Harney. He was the son of a seaman, of the Maha, the fils de Maha, began his work as a very ordinary worker, a shop boy, and he began his politics by selling the newspaper, The Poor Man's Guardian. He went to prison three times because the newspaper was illegal. And so if you sold the newspaper, well, you had to hope that the person who was buying it was not a spy from the police. So he went to prison three times for that, and then got involved in the Chartist the Chartist movement. Harney was one of the delegates of the Chartists in 1839 who argued for a general strike, a grand national holiday on the 12th of August. And Harney went around the country trying to persuade people to join the strike. He was arrested and kept in the prison. And perhaps you remember that the fact that the leaders were arrested was one of the reasons that the strike was difficult to organize. When he appeared at the tribunal to be charged, the jury refused to find him guilty. So this was a system of jury and his jury, and they refused to find him guilty. So there was some sympathy he had. He was rather disappointed by the failure of the general strike. He moved to Scotland, but rapidly came back and became the Chartist organiser in Sheffield, arrested again after the general strike of 1842, but not imprisoned, and worked again on a newspaper on the Northern Star. At this time he met Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, and he managed to persuade them to write articles for the Northern Star. So Karl Marx wrote for the Northern Star. Of course, Karl Marx at the time was not famous at all. In fact, he wasn't famous really until after his death. Karl Marx, when he died, he had a funeral and there were like 12 people. It was a really tiny event. And there was no stone. The stone was added like 50 years later or something. Okay, so Julian Harney became a socialist under the influence of Marx and Ernest Jones. Whereas Fergus O'Connor was not a socialist, did not agree with socialism, and this led Julian Harney to form his own newspaper called the Red Republican. You can imagine, especially in England, in a monarchy, Red Republican is quite a radical title for a newspaper, but they didn't manage to get enough money for it to last very long. And he continued with other newspapers: The Friend of the People, The Star of Freedom, The Vanguard, The Northern Tribune. So that's like when you had no more money, you closed the newspaper and opened another one with another name, you know, to avoid having to pay your debts. And he was very active supporting the North in the American Civil War. Remember the American Civil War, where eventually the North will win and this will be the beginning of the end of slavery. In England, the English elite supported the South, and so there was a campaign to support the North. And in 1863, Harney emigrated to the United States and was rather lucky compared with the other Chartist leaders. He did not die in prison. He did not die in poverty. He continued for 15 years a fairly normal life and died in 1897. Just one more leader, William Cuffey. So I think, you know, the portraits give an idea of, you've got the movement and then what are these leaders doing? Of course, there are many more leaders I couldn't possibly tell you. William Cuffey, rather specific case. One of the four or five black leaders of Chartism. It's always difficult in England being a black leader in politics, and in the 19th century it was even more difficult. Born in England, his father was a freed slave, and he became a tailor. William Cuffey became a tailor and remained a tailor all his life, married three times. Never had any children. At the beginning, when he was a tailor, he was not in favor of trade unions, but little by little he was persuaded and he joined the tailors' strike of 1834 and lost his job, because at the time if he went on strike it'd be very difficult. And the experience of losing his job made him interested in politics. In 1839, then he joins Chartism, and he establishes the Metropolitan Tailors Charter Association, donc l'Association pour la Charte des Tailleurs de Londres. Remember, at the time there are a lot of tailors. Yeah. Today our clothes are made by machines. Yeah, so we think tailors and not many men. There are lots of tailors, tens of thousands of tailors in London. Yeah, many we need to. All of the middle classes have their clothes made by tailors. So he works in the development of the Chartist movement. It becomes very famous. In particular, he would go to political meetings of the of other organisations and heckle. He would shout out his opinions in the floor. And the newspapers hated him, of course, because the newspapers, like the Times, the official newspapers, they hated the Chartists, and of course they hated a black Chartist more. And so in the Times, the London Chartists were referred to as, according to the Times, the London Chartists were the black man and his party. Yeah. So. William Cuffey had become the symbol of Chartists in London. What is the name? Oh, in 1846, he was one of the London delegates to the Land Conference. He was part of the Land Plan. And also he was involved in the campaign for solidarity with Poland. And we'll talk about that at the time. At the time, the big conflict between Poland and the surrounding colonialists, and he's part of that. 1848, then, he has a very left-wing position. And Cuffe's opinion is that they should march on Parliament, and in fact, so I'm trying to think about that. Okay, so Cuffe was part of the people organising this demonstration that he hoped was going to move on Parliament. When the day came and the crowd on Kennington Common was told at the last moment by O'Connor that they were deciding not to march on Parliament, Cuffe was very, very angry and spoke in strong language against the dispersal of the meeting, but he did not have enough influence to make a difference. As you can imagine, the attacks by the establishment on the Chartists were very, very vicious. The Times again: Cuffe is half a nigger. Some of the others are Irishmen. We doubt if there are half a dozen Englishmen in the whole lot. Yeah, so the Times was presenting the Chartists as blacks and Irishmen. Yeah, and they're not real Englishmen. You know, a fairly classic opinion there. Right. He was taken to prison. He was arrested. And one of the things that's famous about Cuffe, and I think you have an extract in here, is that when he spoke at his trial, it was a very impressive speech. And so you have an extract of his trial there. So what happens to him? He is sentenced to transportation. He is sent on holiday to Australia. Yeah, he's sent on holiday, not on holiday, to prison in Australia. Very, very popular among the Chartists. This is what the Northern Star says about Cuffe when he's on trial: the conduct of Cuffe throughout his trial was that of a man. A somewhat singular appearance, certain eccentricities of manner, and a habit of unregulated speech afforded an opportunity to the reporters to make him the subject of their ridicule. In a great measure, Cuffe owes his destruction to the press gang. It is the media that attacked him. But, says the Northern Star, his manly and admirable conduct on his trial affords his enemies no opportunity either to sneer at or abuse him. His protest from first to last against a mockery of being tried by a jury animated by class resentments and party hatred showed him to be a much, much better respecter of the Constitution than the judges were. Okay, and so after a hundred day voyage on the prison ship, Cuffe lands in Tasmania, Australia, and he works there. His wife is allowed to come a few years later, and he works there for 6 years. He is pardoned in 1856. He receives a pardon from the Queen in 1856, the sort of tactic thing. But he decides not to leave Tasmania. In fact, he gets involved in politics in Tasmania, and he continues the fight down there in Tasmania. Defending the rights of workers and trade unions in Tasmania. He dies in the workhouse in Tasmania, so no, he doesn't have any money. He dies in the workhouse, which is the La Maison des Pauvres, but he dies there at the age of 82. À l'époque, extraordinaire d'arriver à l'âge de. Okay, and that's the end of my little story about some of the leaders of the.